podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast, the podcast about the beautiful club within the beautiful game. Back on Zoom after a few match day specials with Peter and I, we are joined by Mr. Andy Bass. Hello and welcome back, Andy.
Yeah, nice. Good to be back.
Excellent. Another point on the board for the Albion. Another non-defeat. That's great, isn't it? We haven't had too many. Only one in five now. It sounds like a good record, doesn't it? So you start adding in the fact we drew with Norwich in there and what happened before. But a 2-2 draw with Southampton at the weekend. We'll be getting into the nitty-gritty of all that coming up in this episode. A bit of a chat about what's happened in the preceding few days before that. And any other news and updates and thoughts on football in general. That's the plan for today. I mean, Andy, I saw you at in the pub pre-match before the game yesterday. I suppose we'll jump straight into that one, shall we, in terms of the game. Pre-match, full of hope, optimism, and was it dashed by the end of the game, having thrown away that two-goal lead? Or were you quite happy in general?
I wasn't confident before because Southampton, again, you know, I don't know how it happens. I mean, we are a difficult team for certain opponents and Southampton always seem to be a bogey team for us, particularly at the Amex, or other than that rare win in the Championship where we surprised everybody by beating them on New Year's Day, I think it was. And the games always seem to be incredibly frustrating. You're always moaning about something when you're coming out of them because, you know, bad refereeing or, you know, some missed chances or a lucky goal for them or something like that. And to be honest, it kind of fully delivered on that front, to be perfectly honest, on Sunday. And ultimately, I think at the end of given the way the second half went, I was quite glad we hadn't thrown the game away completely. So I'll take the point. I think Southampton were definitely up for it. That did not look like a mid-table game. I mean, it was hammer and tong, wasn't it? Both teams really, really going for it. It was very open. Not the cagey affair that I would have expected it to have been. So I think for the neutral, it was probably quite entertaining. But yeah, we had our opportunity to win, to take the 3 points, and we fluffed our lines, sadly.
Yeah, and with Peter, I mean, what are your thoughts on the game? I mean, it's been...
I'm going to start off with obviously, all listeners to the show, well, I love referees, but I honestly thought the referee at the weekend was arguably the worst we've had for quite a long time. He was absolutely dreadful. If you even ignoring the fact that Cucurella was clearly shoved in the back, for the ball bouncing for the first goal, and the fact that Grosch was very questionably offside, which was East Stand linesman, it was also dreadful. Every decision, every 50-50, every 60-40 went Southampton's way, I thought. The number of times that one of our players would put a soft challenge in, you give a free kick, and then somehow miss one with a blatant trip on one of our players. I've not heard of him before, Robert Jones, I think his name was, but he was genuinely a dreadful referee. I don't understand how you can be that one-sided. You know, it's obviously a bit except for the Cucurella one, wasn't very big decisions, but it was just every single time they went down, they got a free kick. And the behaviour of their, was it the winger, Teller or what his name was, who went down three times, rolled over, and then suddenly, magically, a second later, was running around again. And that last time he did it, when he just stood on the ground and hopped for a little bit and then collapsed onto the floor, was just, ridiculous, frankly.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I'm wondering because Teller, I suppose, what could his nickname be? Bank Teller Banky, or maybe somebody that rhymes with that. Possibly, I don't know. Just being rude.
Right, man.
But he was up to all sorts of shenanigans. I agree that all of the niggly stuff was there, wasn't it? In terms of the decision making, the ref was pretty leaning one way in terms of decisions, and that lino was terrible. There's a ball that clearly went out for a corner and wasn't given, which was so obvious. I know I was near side. Yeah, I mean, we were near side to it, Andy, weren't it? I know he was far side to it, but it must have still been obvious. And he wasn't quite in line with it, and he should have been. He wasn't following the play.
That's kind of his job, isn't it? It's just one thing. And he was right in line with where Cucurella and I think it was Teller then as well, were running back. Yeah. And on match day, you can clearly see, and I thought at the time as well, he puts his two hands up and pushes him. Now, it's not a huge shove, but when you're underneath a ball like that, that's enough. And put two hands to someone's back, that to me is a foul. Even if, I mean, you know, slight contact.
It's probably as impacting as the sort of like the quick flick out foot that led to the free kick that was subsequently awarded. I don't see there was any more impact between the two. I didn't see it at the time because I tried to beat the queue for the toilets at half time. So missed the goal, heard the muffled cheer from the other end. I thought, oh, really? Because we got our second goal pretty late in the half, relatively speaking. And I thought, that's great to see that out, see the beginning of the second half out, and then it's game on for our first win in ages at home. But
that goal gave them such a lift and was such a downer on us that it just carried on to the second half. And if they didn't get goal, I'm not sure they would have come back. It was such a big moment. And obviously giving a free kick like that with Will Prowse around is quite often, you know, you've got a good chance. You can probably afford to give it if it's against us. We never score that sort of thing. But with Will Prowse around, it's like, you're guaranteed to probably at least test the keeper. There was another one as well earlier where I think on the corner of the area where their guy went down under, I think it was Cucurea or someone, and threw himself down. And that wasn't a foul either. The guy was not touched and he just threw himself to the floor and the referee fell for it. But that time as well, one or two of the challenges, obviously, there was one right in front of us in the east where March was clearly fouled. There was one on the other side of the pitch where Mwepu, I think it was, tried to go past the guy and was just taken out and he waved play on.
Oh, yeah, that was incredible as well. I mean, it was just like, And then, this is just like blaming the ref edition. But then there was an offside or something, and we were on the attack, and we were like marauding halfway up the pitch, and then he calls it back to give us the free kick rather than play.
Oh, he didn't even look, did he? He didn't.
And
even
then
look
there are other times where he did play the advantage when it was not so advantageous. We did enough to not win the game on our own without blaming the ref. But I still think I thought it was a noteworthily bad performance by the referee. And some of it was just mystifying to me.
Yeah, I mean that counter attack that was prevented by the non-playing of the advantage.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten about that. That was actually really infuriating because we'd done very well to negate the danger, to turn that from a dangerous-looking attack for them into one for us. And you could see the breakaway potential there. I think we were still inside our half when he pulled it, but you know there was room ahead of us to exploit, and that would have been great, and especially at that point in the game as well. Really frustrating. Yeah,
he didn't even look around the pitch. He just looked back, saw the flag and blew. He didn't even think to turn around and look, which is surely one of the first things referees. I mean, it's such a simple thing, and it's so frustrating when you're really checking.
Sorry, go on, Andy. He didn't look comfortable, did he? He didn't look settled or relaxed in the role. I know it might be early days for him. I think is it his first full season this year or something? I don't know. But he didn't look comfortable with what he was doing. And obviously, to be fair, it doesn't help having a linesman. I'm going to still call them that to annoy anyone that doesn't like the modernised expressions. But the linesman on that east side, that didn't help him, obviously, because he's then got someone who's equally...
you can't call him an assistant referee because he didn't assist the referee, did he? So,
yes.
So you have to call him a linesman, really, don't you? I mean, ironically, he managed somehow to spot the Grosch offside, which was by, if it was offside even. I mean, I know their VAR lines are random sometimes that you never quite know if they've got it right. But even on theirs, it was really next to each other. And people were saying, I thought this season, if they were right next to each other, the attacker would get the benefit of the doubt.
I mean, it was very, very marginal. I we'll probably go into that in a little bit more detail in a minute.
We'll discuss it later.
We'll come to that later. But I did initially think it was offside, but we'll come into that in a minute. But let's talk.
It would have been nice if Match Today had actually analysed it rather than just analysing Ward Prowse, the only thing they did.
Yeah, best thing since sliced bread, of course, you know. And I am a big fan of Ward Prowse. I think he's a great player.
Yeah, so am I. And absolutely talk about him, but also talk about the disallowed goal and maybe show the shove as well and actually talk about Brighton maybe and mention the fact we played the game.
Yeah, because we were playing, definitely.
And I thought so, but apparently not.
Certainly we were playing better in the first half. We got off to a cracking start, didn't we? I mean, it was a good atmosphere. I do think the atmosphere was obviously helped by the fact we scored a goal in the 75th second of the game, I think it was. But I think it was going to be a good atmosphere anyway. It was a bright, sunny day. The crowd seemed up for it right from the off. And obviously that was enhanced by Welbeck prodding home a loose ball after some kind of some interesting attacking movements down the left-hand side. We got the cross in. I don't think Southampton dealt with things very well at all. There's a bit of a mix-up. It bobbled over the goalkeeper somehow. And Welbeck was there to prod it home. 75 seconds gone, 1-0. Thank you very much. Everything's hunky-dory. And then, of course...
our quickest Premier League goal, apparently, I read this morning.
Yeah, I thought it must be close to. Yeah, I can't really remember. I think we had one very early one away somewhere once at some point, but I can't quite remember. But, you know, Welbeck started and rewarded with that choice. I think it was, I wouldn't say a well-taken goal because, you know, it was an easy opportunity by the time it dropped to him. But, you know, great, we'll take it. We carried on playing well during that half. Saints had, I think they hit the post, didn't they, at one point with a dangerous attack. Which I think was Adams. I can't remember now.
Livramento hit the post.
Oh, it was Livramento, yeah. And they had a couple of other threats, but I think by and large, we were the better side in that first half.
You gave them a lot of space on the flanks quite a lot of the time, both sides. They had quite a lot of room on, especially that one. I mean, he had so much space to run into and then take the shots. Yeah. And we were quite lucky on that it somehow hit Sanchez and avoided. I think it was maybe Adams, but avoided at the far post.
Yeah, Adams was flailing away trying to poke it.
And I mean, speaking of Livramento, of course, was a target for the Albion, but we couldn't get a deal over the line. He ended up going from Chelsea to Southampton. And unfortunately, looked like a serious injury. In the 35th, 36th minute, something like that, he went over with what looked like a badly turned ankle, possibly a broken ankle. I haven't seen what the news is on it, actually. But clearly it was a bad one. Although he was under pressure with someone near him, no contact. It was just one of those things, as usual, with those scenarios. Someone goes down without a clear-cut contact. You know,
Webby just turned him, I think, didn't he?
He just turned
to try and follow him, and he must have caught his studs or something, yeah.
Or
his foot just nasty, on his turf, and his body went one way, and his foot just stayed where it was. But, it looked genuine. Yeah. I mean, he still looked in agony as he was coming off. So
Really
hope he's all right because he's a very good player.
Yeah, wish him a speedy recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. You never like to see that. And he got well applauded from everybody around the ground, which is good to see, as you'd expect, but still good to see. And as you said, Andy, he still had his arms on above his head and hands on his face. He was still in some degree of pain there. So it will be a bad one, I'm sure. But we wish him a speedy recovery because, as I said, you don't like to see that. And I think he was sort of a fairly involved player as well, so it may have affected Saints a bit at that stage. I mean, not much else happened before we got to the point where we got our first goal, of course, which came just towards the end of the half. A nice finish from Saints, I thought, to a really good move, which included a great pass from Danny Welbeck as he
Welbeck winning it back in the first place as well.
He sort of nicked into the ball, hit it with the outside of his boot. Really good long range, mid-range crossfield pass. The threat was in there, and as the ball came across, Welbeck was coming back in towards the far side. Probably a pretty good chance he was going to finish that if it wasn't intercepted. Unfortunately for their guy, is it Salisa? I think his name is. He buried it with aplomb, as they say, right in the
keeper had no chance.
That's right. I had a good view of that, actually. Second he hit it, I thought, yep, that's great, that's in. And 2-0, and I don't think anyone could have complained at that stage.
Well, yeah, I think you kind of... We actually were really busy in that first half. I thought throughout the first half, I thought we were on top until they got their first goal. A lot of energy. There seemed to be an awful lot of space all over the pitch for both teams. I certainly think we conceded way too much space on the flanks for us in the second half when they were like really tearing into us. But I think we were doing exactly the same thing in the first half to them. And I liked the speed at which we were moving out. I thought Nwepu and Caicedo... We're working well together again, and Canister as well. Welbeck, I just thought he's really getting back to full fitness now because he's all over that pitch. He's stretching the field. Mope, there's a lot. Some people didn't think Mope had a good game on Saturday. I thought he was excellent again.
Yeah, I did, especially the first half.
In the first half, he was really physically strong. He was holding the ball up, making sure that attacks were continuing and they weren't just getting bogged down. He was winning the second ball. He was winning that toss. He was always flicking it on to Trossard or to whoever was coming in support. I thought he was excellent. Very unfortunate not to score from the little chance that Welbeck had from the knockout against Forster.
And it was also him who made our other best chance of the half, which was the one where I think Mepu couldn't quite bring it down, so paid it to Welbeck, who Forster saved it at his near post. It was Mope on the wing to hold off the defender and then cross back to Mepu that was like kind of led to that chance. Yeah. I thought excellent as well. I thought he and Welbeck led from the pressurised them. They couldn't deal with it. But I also did think Saints had a lot of... I didn't necessarily think 2-0 reflected the game at that point. I think Saints had quite a few chances. Like when they hit the post, obviously they had quite a lot of possession at times. And we didn't necessarily deal that well, as in the space that Andy was talking about. I thought 2-1 at half-time, maybe even 1-1 would have been... was a fair reflection of if he'd held on to 2-0. Doesn't mean I'm not annoyed the fact that they got the free kick and did it, but I thought they had spells where they were well on top of them. And there were a number of corners, a number of long throws.
Yeah, I'd also just add on the Morphe front, I think he was working incredibly hard, and thumbs up to him. I thought he had a good game, particularly in the first half. I also agree that Southampton were a good side, aren't they? They are a good side, and they look kind of good sitting in as an away side as well, looking to pick teams off and take advantages at certain moments in games. And as you said, they created and presented a threat, hitting the post, one or two other threatening moments as well, which looked pretty dangerous at the time. So while I do think no one could necessarily complain with the 2-0 because we would have had at half-time had it not been for that late pullback goal. But I do think probably 2-1 was a fairer reflection on the overall balance. Yeah, I would say so. Which is a bit of a shame, of course, from our point of view. As we've said, we could have just seen it out for that last moment of... I mean, they added 5 minutes, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I think the stoppage was at least 4.5, wasn't it? And then there's goal celebrations where we was down briefly.
I think it was pretty much all the stoppage, because first half, they really had on stuff for, like, celebrations.
Yeah.
Or anything.
Probably not. But anyway, the goal came in the last minute, I think, of... or just before the last minute of that first half stoppage time. Ward-Prowse from, as you said, Peter, a counter-attack, sort of like a breakaway, a mistake, I think we can say. And their man jumps in. Kukureya gets pushed in the build-up. I definitely think there was a shove there that was affecting, maybe not the most dramatic, but it, as you said, it does put the player off and it does change the balance slightly, particularly if he's in mid-air, which he sort of half was, wasn't it, at the time?
Yeah.
Then, of course, cuts inside. He's just clipped by the same player's leg coming out. And we've conceded a free kick in a central area against the team that you'd least want to concede a free kick against. Because, yes, the BBC were waxing lyrical about him, but he is bloody good, isn't he, Ward-Prowse? He'd had a free kick earlier in the half, but that was much further out to the right. And that was just going to be a matter of dealing with the delivery into the area. But with this one, you just knew what was coming. It's a direct free kick going to be taken. And essentially, as I said to someone yesterday when we were watching the game, really Ward-Prowse with a free kick in a central position is genuinely more dangerous than us with a penalty.
Yeah,
it genuinely is, in terms of probabilities of goals, as proved by the fact he subsequently did bury it indeed. But as we were talking about just off air, Andy, frustrating in the way he actually scored it. It wasn't that he buried it right in the top corner and we couldn't do anything about it. It was actually preventable, at least in terms of where he placed it.
I think, you know, the wall, to be honest, that free kick was not as good as it appeared to be in real time. Obviously, when he scored it, I thought, Ward-Prowse, brilliant. Having watched the replays of it, I'm absolutely horrified, quite frankly. I thought at the time when Sanchez was lining up, I thought he was too central. I kind of get why he did it, because he knows that Ward-Prowse can hit it in either side. So if he goes too heavily towards one side, he's kind of like giving him a free hit. So I kind of understand that. So I think Ward-Prowse's reputation has kind of got into the heads of Sanchez and the defence. But when you look at that wall, the final third of it towards the west side was just totally broken. It wasn't remotely solid. There was just like the ball just had like this massive gap to go through. And because Sanchez was slightly more central than you would normally expect in that instance, you'd expect him to really favour one side of the goal over the other. He was just a little bit too far away. And he was slightly slow to react because he was behind the bit of the wall that he couldn't see through.
Yeah.
It was,
and it did go in off the post as well, so it was right as far as he could possibly get.
I mean, fair play to Ward-Prowse because I think his reputation, I think he does have an effect on the people. I think, the defenders are always going to be slightly paranoid when they face him. But to be honest, I don't think that was a worldie. I think with the wall, it should have been stopped by the wall. I think they just got out, they just evaporated and got out of the way. And maybe Sanchez could have been a bit positioned better. I'm not saying he could have got there quicker, because I think from where he was, it was probably going to be difficult for him, given the placement of the ball in that corner, the bottom corner anyway. That was defendable. And I think that's something that they're going to have to look at, because I just thought it was an utterly shambolic bit of defending on the wall.
It was disappointing. I mean, it was about mid-height kind of level, wasn't it? For anyone that hasn't seen it, it was much lower than where he normally curls it over the wall. And as you said, that mid-height thing, we shouldn't be conceding free kicks like that. One bit of credit as well for Ward-Prowse, I think, is I do think he's very reactive in a good way, in terms of he'll sniff the danger and he will adapt what he might have been planning to do. Mm-hmm. So he might have had a notion of going into one particular corner and seeing what was happening with that wall. He was able to exploit that, as you said, Peter, in off the post, I think. So, he was deadly accurate with what he then changed to do. So he's a brilliant set piece guy. Hats off to him. I think he's on 14 Premier League direct free kick goals, isn't he? And I think that's four behind Beckham. And assuming nothing dramatically bad happens to him, I can't see anything other than him going way past that figure by the time he hangs up his boots, assuming he stays in the Premier League, of course.
We were talking at the game. There was like there were Southampton players a lot closer to our wall than you're supposed to be these days. I thought there was supposed to be a gap, and then they moved off, I think, afterwards. But I think there was maybe a distraction there, and that's why the wall kind of got broken up a bit, and that might have been what kind of like led to that. Because obviously the wall was, completely useless, effectively. Yeah. I mean, it can't be called a wall, can it? but I wonder if that was what maybe distracted. And they are supposed to be further away now, but whether they got away with it because they'd moved further away by the time
they... Castle ruins, maybe, call it that instead.
Yeah. Yeah, the Maginot line, maybe, more than that. It was frustrating because we should have defended it better, and it shouldn't have been given in the first place. So all in all, it was quite frustrating from all aspects.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between 2-0 and 2-1 at half-time in terms of the psychology, how you set up, if you go in at 2-0, you've got a pretty much a different game plan, I think, to some degree, haven't you, in terms of what's instructed and how you set up to start that second half. You can look to exploit on the counter more and that kind of thing. But with 2-1, suddenly, it's a different sort of game. Having said that, of course, the second half also didn't start too well, because it was only 9 minutes into it when Romeo, in the 54th minute, set up Ward-Prowse for another goal. Two observations from my end. I've been thinking this for a while, by the way. Oriol Romeo, is it me or does he remind you of Adam Alabt a bit? I think there's a certain similarity. Yeah. It always bugs me.
It's similar to the way they play as well, judging by the number of bookings he gets as well.
Yes, yeah. But he's a good player. And it was a good goal from their point of view. Mistake from ours, I guess, as is often the case when you concede, isn't it? But Romeo set up Ward-Prowse, and this was an open play goal. Again, great technique. Took it first time, boom, in the corner. And it was 2-2.
You sensed the minute it came back to him, you just knew he was going to score.
Yeah. It was just like a moving free kick. He's not going to
even less
precisely his range. So I mean, it was a great back heel by Romeo that set him up. I mean, that was a really nice bit of skill, and I don't think you can really defend that. I mean, it's a shame again. You know, Webster did what he normally does on his returns from injuries. Normally, it needs a couple of games to get the rust out, and sadly that proved to be the case yet again, because we did give the ball away cheaply, and I think that was the frustrating thing. And in the first half, I thought we were very fluid going forward. We did create some good opportunities. Obviously, disallowed goal, the melee on the line, and other opportunities for us to maybe to have got picked up another goal. But in the second half, I think we got anxious again. Too many times we would just be sloppy and just giving the ball away cheaply. And it is a problem that this team has. It is something that they're going to need to continually work on. But just, when we're at our full concentration, we're excellent. But the minute that slides, it puts us in a difficult position. And I don't know, it felt like Southampton were just, it was wave after wave of attack. And I was really only see one team winning it.
I was fearing. I was fearing for us as well in that.
So I was going from 2 points dropped to really just like hung on to a point. Mm. And then, of course, we have the disappointment of the gross offside goal. And again, another exquisite bit of transition. I think that I could see why the linesman might have been thinking, oh, he's offside, because simply because there was no one near him. I mean, he was in that massive, they left that massive gap in the middle. But when you looked at the lines that they drew up,
yeah, that looked
his feet are miles behind the defender. I think he's only
it's the lean in, isn't it?
It must have been like an elbow or something. I mean,
I thought they were giving attackers the benefit of the doubt for those ones this season.
Yeah.
I understand it was, because it was ridiculous that these goals were disallowed with, such a small, there's a really well taken finish and a nice move. And to then have that disallowed because of, such a, and from a linesman who basically was asleep most of the game, to suddenly wake up to one offside, like by that, that tiny amount was kind of a reflection of our luck.
Yeah.
I was under the impression, like, if it's really that borderline and you're trying to have to... Because, to be honest, the longer they were taking to make the decision, I thought, they might allow this. But clearly it's not obvious. He's not clearly offside by a yard. He's in all that open space and he might have looked in that moment to be about a yard clear or something like that. But his feet were behind. So I can only assume that, like... There was like an elbow, his arm was in front, and that's what they deemed to be, because they do like the arm and shoulder, don't they?
I thought they just changed that because there was a lot of complaints about, is it the Palace player who's pointing forward, or Leeds player at Palace who was pointing
forward? Bamford, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It Bamford, wasn't it? Yeah. Who was pointing forward, and that was
awesome. I mean, wasn't it that he's leaning forwards, though? You could say scorable body parts, head and so on, would then come into play. Although the lines are obviously lined up to the feet, which doesn't really clarify matters, does it?
His feet were behind. I mean, he was standing behind. They found a body part slightly in advance by a few millimetres. I think the authorities have to say, how much of an advantage is that player getting?
Especially when he being gross, of course, he held onto the ball. A couple of players advanced beyond him, defenders, and then he sort of composed himself and then shot. So he didn't have a space advantage as such in terms of forwards, because defenders were coming back. It was more a case of nobody picked him up directly. They just tried to block some of the space ahead of him, but then he shot it in the corner with a great finish, which is a shame not to be a winning goal. But I have to say, when I was watching it, I was more or less in line with it, where I'm in the West Upper, and I instantly thought it was offside. And then I was convinced of that. And when we did score it, although I started getting to my feet, in case we were celebrating a goal, I did notice that the linesman put his flag up straight away. I was looking for it, and everyone around me was celebrating. Nobody else seemed to have clocked it at all. And I was the harbinger of doom.
Yeah, we caught the same from the east as well. Yeah. And again, I looked straight for the flag once it went.
And I was a bit surprised, because I thought it was more off than it was when I then eventually saw it later that night. I thought that was actually a good sort of half a yard off, at least, maybe more. But it is it's a deception of the eye, isn't it?
I think the timing. I think if that goal had been allowed, nobody would be complaining about it.
No, and that's what comes back to the clear and obvious thing, and the small margins and advantage to the attacker. It really is in such a small level, isn't it?
The Lino was not up with play. He was about a yard behind.
It was, yeah.
Behind Grosch. I can see.
Well, he saw what I thought, though, as well, at the time.
I can see why.
I can understand it.
I thought it was a goal at the time, but I can see why it might have looked offside, because there wasn't anyone within 15 yards of him. He was just thinking, how could he be in that much space? He must be offside.
But that's what VAR's there for, isn't it? To avoid those perceptions.
Yeah, so you go to the VAR to check it, but I thought it would be given.
Yeah.
My friend AD was, he said it's not a goal. I said, yes, it is. Misery Guts was right, but
it's
frustrating. As Graham Potter would say, it is what it is. I think that's something the authorities have to look at, and they have to ask, what is the point of this law? I mean, the point is to stop people goal hanging and stealing, an unearned advantage by being an advanced player. I just think they have to look at how they word that law, because I don't think if it's down to millimeters, or if it's like less than an inch, then you just play on. I think you've got to be stealing an advantage. I don't see in that instance that Gross had really got an advantage. There was no one near him. He was clearly going to get the ball because there was no defender there to close him down.
Gross could have been 5 yards offside and still not have an advantage, really. Your point endures, really. I agree. It's there to stop blatant goal hanging, which spoils the balance of the game. If someone's standing in yards and yards of space offside, that would affect the whole nature of football, and you can't have just getting rid of offside. People say, "I'll just get rid of it." It wouldn't be a good spectacle. It could be mad.
Of half each team, like defending deep and attacking deep, and the other half just hoofed it back and forward.
People would adapt, and there would be some interesting scenarios developed from that.
It just wouldn't be a midfield, basically.
But Andy's point in the end, though, it's true, isn't it? It's just, if there's no real advantage, discernible one, that's part of the art of the game, isn't it, to try and time those runs. I remember I just watched the Liverpool Man U game as well. I caught up with that one, that match of the day episode this week as well. And Salah had a chance when it was 4-0, could have buried it for 5, which I didn't know at the time he'd had that chance. I'm glad I didn't know, because I had a bet on them winning 5-0 when it was 2-0. So that was quite annoying he didn't bury it. But I for all the world, thought that was offside. And then when you look back at it, he's clearly a good sort of inch or two onside. And you think, okay,
I think that's the thing.
The trick of the eye is the thing, isn't it? But if it's that close,
but also,
your eye's tricked.
The VAR lines do feel quite random as well, though. I think that's part of the issue as well.
That looked odd, that line, didn't it? It looked slightly murky in one spot.
Yeah. I'm still not convinced it was offside, and that's the thing. Even a line for the inches, I'm still not convinced those lines reflect when I've seen a still of it. So, I mean, it would have been really good match if they'd actually bothered to analyse it and have a look at it. It's probably the main incident, well, the two main incidents of the game, I would say, was Cucurella being fouled in the build-up to the goal and the offside for the goal. And all they talked about was Ward-Prowse, who is worth discussing, but also their whole point is to talk about slightly controversial incidents. And those two, in my mind, were both controversial. And I think probably around they would have talked about it, but because it's Brighton, they don't bother.
Yeah. So. And I mean, while, if they had given the foul for Cucurella, and then pulled the free kick out of the equation for them. And if they'd given that goal, you know, people might have said we've been a bit lucky there, and maybe they'd be right in that case because they're marginal decisions or ambiguous decisions. But ultimately, we've not. I don't think we've had a particularly good share of good decisions, have we, overall? I'd certainly take the luck against Man U, because we bloody owe them loads of that regard.
You can really say it's Leicester that we've had luck this season. In the rules of the game, I still think all those decisions were correct. But you could argue on another day that it would go against us. But other than that, I actually thought that the goal was, we finished really strongly in the end. I think Southampton lost their way a bit. And I think they tired towards the last 15 minutes or so. And we came back into the game quite a lot. And yeah, quite impressively. They lost their way. And actually, we finished the stronger and looked the most likely to win it later.
Yeah, the bringing on of March and Gross really worked.
Yeah, just after the hour, wasn't it?
Yeah. March is a really good sub. I mean, I feel sorry for him because I wish he would be better from the start of games. But he's
got a good first touch, doesn't he? He's got a good swagger about him when he's on the ball. It is his final ball and his inclination to hold on to the ball rather than put a first-time cross in is probably the biggest issue there. But he, final product sometimes a miss. But he is a good player. He is a good player. He's worthy of a squad place, I think, still. He added some spark, didn't he, along with Grosz, who seemed to go all over the place. I mean, this game we started off with four at the back, didn't we? Veltman and Cucurella in the wider roles, Webster and Dunk central, Wepu, McAllister, Trossard, effectively the midfield, Caicedo as well, interspersing with Trossard, and then Morpay and Welbeck up front. But when Grosz came on, that was for Webster, and March came on for Mwepu. And Grosz, at one point, was playing as a right-back, and on several occasions was playing as a left-winger in certain moments. And it really, I don't know how deliberate that was by the coach versus the player individually, but I think that mixing it up and moving about all over the place helped. And I think the subs in general did help us.
You think it's pace?
For a player that's famously known for how slow he is.
Yeah, he had some energy, though.
Grosz covers so much ground.
Yeah, he really does.
He is like an optical illusion. in the fact that he, despite the fact he moves slowly, he apparently appears to be everywhere all the time. And how he's managed to... And he reads the game very well. That's why he found himself in acres of space.
Do you think there were three Grosz's on the pitch, two of which any time were wearing cloaks of invisibility or something?
That would explain a lot. I find that more believable than actually Pascal's ability to cover every blade of grass.
Maybe it was his cloak that was offside.
But one of the other Grosz's was offside and they'd spotted it somehow. The other sub was Sarmiento, came on at the 85th minute, and I've been crying for him to come out probably 5-10 minutes earlier than that. I wish he would have had more time to make an impact. He wasn't able to really do much in the game. There wasn't really the spaces at the moments when he was getting the ball, but you could see he's got that energy and dynamism, and you want to see him have a longer run, don't you, really? Especially when there's nothing very, very important running on the game. I mean, we're grappling for positions in the table, but, you know, safety is assured, and it would have been nice to have seen him get a bit more time ahead of when games will be more crucial again early in next season.
Yeah, I think he came on and he was just played a little bit too far forward because he basically went up to almost be, you know, just like a centre forward, when I think he's much better when he gets the ball deeper and then attacks the defenders rather than him being already up there. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it'd be nice if he could have had, you know, maybe not advocating for him to start, but if he could get like 20 minutes here and there. But, we were trying to win the game. So Grosz and March, the two tried and tested players, that's clearly the sensible decision to do when, you know, Potter was trying to turn the match around and still try and win it. I mean, both teams were, you know, you can forget your mid-table mediocrity. Both teams were trying to win the game. It was a good... It was a good high energy effort from both sides, even if, you know, Southampton spent half the time rolling around on the pitch. But
Yeah, they do have a lot of energy. They were playing a really high press game in the first match at St Mary's earlier in the season. They are a fit team. They're full of energy and running. The only thing from that St Mary's game, actually, which has surprised me a little bit, was Breuer didn't start the game. He only came on in the 79th minute. There may have been a reason for that beyond tactics. But I'm surprised and relieved that he didn't start the game because I think he's a really good player.
I wonder if they know they're not going to be able to sign him permanently and they're like, well, now we're going to go to our players who we know will be there next season. And maybe they think with Chelsea's issues, they're not going to, they might look to bring him in, but, you know, into the squad. Yeah, can't afford him. And so go
that's
with,
probably made a difference to the Saints, hasn't it? I think that situation with Abramovic.
In terms of the subs, I do think we're a bit limited in the sense that we had to take Webster off, I reckon, obviously. Only able to do an hour. I wonder if we had to take Webster off as well, because he'd obviously started four games in a row, having not started for a while. And I know he went off at half time at Spurs, but I wonder whether he was a bit knackered at that point, because he played, you know, four games pretty much at Man City and Arsenal, half a game at Tottenham and an hour here, and I wonder whether stamina wise he was just a bit, he just couldn't. So that limited on what we could change. And obviously the players were brought on, bringing Sarmiento on for either of those would have been a lot more attacking rather than Grosch or March, who could play a bit deeper. Yeah.
Possibly. Only two other thoughts from my side of it. One was to mention Lamptey wasn't involved at all. We don't know. We understand there might have been some sort of minor injury that they precautionarily decided to keep him out of the squad. The other point of note was Welbeck was given man of the match at the stadium, also highest rated on some of the websites. Would you agree with that? I mean, he scored the first goal. He was heavily involved in the second one. He caused the second one to be a goal, both in the build-up and the pressure on the defender. And had a generally good all-round game. And as you said, I think it was you, Andy, said that he seems to be back to full fitness and looks a threat. Would you agree with that? Or was there someone else you think deserved man of the match?
I agree with it completely.
I agree with it.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Even without the goals, I thought he had a brilliant game. And as Andy said, he's pressed and the way he chased back. I mean, a number of times he actually covered the gaps on the wing and came back and worked so hard. And he had a really good game. And he deserved it, no question in my mind.
Yeah, I thought he's outstanding, and he's brought a physicality, you know, that physicality that we do lack. I think he's brought that back into his game. I was really impressed with him. Veltman, I think, is the other person that had a more noteworthy game. I thought, it was an okay performance. It was just we just let ourselves down with some sloppy play that enabled them to get their two goals and maybe one or two half chances that we could have done a little bit better with. I think it was frustrating from that point of view, but I did think Southampton were really good in the second half, and I was, to be honest, I was pleased that we didn't concede a third. So I'll take the point. We've gone to 41 now. We've equaled the record, so we've got a few more games to add to that total and hopefully set a new record. And it's only one defeat in five now, isn't it? So
And that was at City, which is you can't, I mean, we're almost supposed to lose that. I thought, as an exercise in seeing ahead without Bissouma for next season, it's pretty good, actually, to be honest. Add a fully fit Webster rather than the Webster that we saw coming back in. A fully fit Lamptey, Wepu and Casino with more games behind them and more experience in the Premier League, and potentially a couple of new signings. And actually, that's not a bad team for next season if we can keep them fit. I mean, the players like Wepu and Webster, the key based on, and Welbeck as well, the key on this based on this season will be keeping them fit. Because obviously, those three have all missed quite big chunks. Welbeck, I've never had any question that he's good enough for us ability wise. It's just been that he's always liable to get injured. And touch wood, since he's had that bad injury in the season, they reckon they've sorted something out. And he seems to be okay now. And he seems to be, he's not starting every game, but he seems to get involved. And that was his best game I've seen him play for Albion, I thought, at the weekend.
You get the impression, even if he's not starting every game, that might even just be only tactical reasons rather than anything to do with nursing a situation. It's good news, isn't it, for him and for us.
Yeah, add in Undav and another striker maybe, and maybe Van Hecker at the back to offer more options. And suddenly a team that I still think we really need another wing back option so that when Lamptey's not available, we don't have to adapt a bit. We've got another option, like Livramento would have been if we managed to sign him, I think, in the summer. And obviously agree, otherwise they wouldn't have been in for him. Someone like him, if March's happy to stay, I'm happy with him as backup to Cucurella. I think we need one more centre back option, maybe Clark or Odegaard, or maybe someone new, possibly, if Duffy goes. Then, midfield, we maybe need one more option with Modder out, but not necessarily first choice. If Caicedo and McAllister and Wepu are playing well together, then those three could be first choice.
Further forward, if
Trossard stays, I suppose.
There's a few rumours around that Welbeck may have agreed a deal now, or agreed to have the extra year.
Yeah.
I know there's an option there anyway, but I think it might be, there's rumours it might be mutually agreed that he's going to stay on, which I think makes sense. It fleshes the squad out well, particularly if we don't get another striker in on top of Undaf. And we're still not knowing what's happening with Morpé. I certainly think we need, in terms of numbers, I think it would be useful to keep him, particularly given what you said about his fitness seeming to be resolved now. And yeah, as you said, those players to come in and maybe one or two other signings we don't know about yet, things are looking up for next season. And I'm really
Sado is a real bonus. He looks so good.
He's great, doesn't he? I mean, that challenge of Man City.
He's like fourth start Premier League start. And he looks like he's been there for years, doesn't he?
Do you see that defensive challenge against City? Brilliant. Sliding in from the side and just put the ball away.
Bobby Moore-esque.
There was one against Spurs as well, wasn't there, when they looked like they were going to break away and he hooked it around his leg and came away with it as well. He just looks a class above. And I mean, I know Tim Vickery's been saying, he's going to be amazing for a while, but you look at that and you think, well, actually, yeah, he looks like a player he's played. He's going to be first choice, I think, next season, and he's only 2021. And I don't know how long he'll be here, to be honest. We might get a couple of seasons out of him and then he'll go for quite a lot more than Bissouma, I'd have thought.
I should say we still only beat Tottenham because I think this is actually your buddy Vicky, actually, Andy, said this on Twitter, that Spurs were missing two of their key players, Son and Kane, when we played them. If that was a great whoever it was anyway, yeah, great quote.
I don't know. Yeah, Spurs kind of needed them to play against us, and sadly they were.
They were missing against Brentford as well. No shots on target again, apparently, in their 0-0 draw. And we'll talk a bit more about football in general in part two, but I'm eager to get the half-time whistle in case we concede a late free kick. So we'll probably have a quick break there. And in part two, we'll do a bit more of a general football discussion. So back in just a moment. And so we follow part one with part two. Who knew? Still with Andy and Peter and me, Russell, for just a general look at football now. So, I mean, first of all, last episode, we did a bit of a mini match day special at the weekend, not on the Albion, but on Worthing, because it was the final one of our little features for the season on Worthing, non-league special number six, where Peter and I, and my other half, went down to Worthing for the day trip and to see the final game of the season. Worthing beat Brightlingsea Regent, your favourably named football team, isn't it, Peter? Great name. 1-0. Andy, unfortunately, does go to Worthing games, wasn't able to go to that one due to other commitments, but it was the trophy presentation and it was a job well done. They finished on 97 points. They thoroughly deserved the title and they thoroughly deserved it, particularly after what's gone on before. We had a good day down there, didn't we, Peter? The beers aren't that great at the ground, actually, but we had some good beers before and after around.
The beers didn't live up to Horsham, I'm afraid, you say.
Spanky but donkey. Oh, it's worth going back to Horsham just for that name, isn't it, really? It was a good day out, and Worthy looked great, didn't they? And I'm pretty sure they'll fit into the division above next season perfectly well. Andy, any thoughts, final reflections on that for Worthing's end of season, which, of course, is what that was, the last game. What's your thoughts on that, finally?
Oh, just really delighted for them. I just think it's an incredible story. I mean, I just can't imagine any other team having the resilience to get themselves promoted three times in a row from the same division, having to cope with what's happened in the last 2 years. I mean, for them to dominate the division over 3 years, it's just utterly amazing. An absolutely amazing job by Hinch in managing that group of players. Terrific effort from the players. and always backed by some pretty great fans, actually. I mean, it's a really fun place to go and watch a game of football. And if the Albion schedule allows, hopefully pick up one or two more interesting grounds next season in the National League South.
Yeah, indeed. There's some interesting ones there. One of the big appeals, we talked about it at the weekend in the pub, weren't we, Andy, that Dulwich Hamlet will be a great one to be able to go to if schedules allow. That would be in particularly good. And there's lots of other good ones at that level. And I'm looking forward to hopefully catching some more games. It's been an interesting adventure to finally get back to seeing them live. I haven't seen them before this season for a long time in a competitive game. And as you said, the fan base has really grown, both in terms of numbers and in terms of noise. They've got a good repertoire of songs that make a hell of a racket down there, particularly at the weekend. And it's a real feel-good. And they're doing things at the stadium. I think they'll probably add in a couple of other elements again this year, one or two which will be required, no doubt, by going up the level, but also some improvements such as an extra bar, I think they're doing, and all sorts of other bits. Good bunch of people. The commentators are great down there. Peter and James, who we spoke to. Well, I spoke to James again at the weekend. It was good to have a chat with them. And we did have a chat with George, the owner, who's going to come on. He was agreed to come on to a podcast at some point, which we'll probably do over the summer. Maybe a final reflection on Worthing season. We'll try and get some involvement on that one. So, so congratulations to Worthing. Lewis, unfortunately, did miss out on the playoffs, didn't they? But Hastings got promoted into the same division. We'll probably do, a non-league special down there one day next season as well.
And non-league are in the playoffs as well, aren't they? I think it's quite a lot of
Right. Yeah.
And Eastbourne are currently in the playoffs in National League South as well.
So yeah.
Quite a season for Sussex teams.
Absolutely fantastic season for non-league football in Sussex. Just
Littlehampton. FA Vars,
Just absolutely great news for fans all over the county. It's just you'd love to see it. It's just brilliant. So
and the crowd,
some of the crowds as well. There's been some amazing crowds for the levels they're at, and
Few Sussex games pushed 2,000. It was about 1,800 at Worthing, I think, and they could have got more in. I think there must have been a restriction on numbers just to be on the safe side or something, because they could definitely.
I thought it was 2,500 on Saturday, wasn't it?
Oh, sorry, but maybe I misread the. I forgot to check it, actually. Yeah, was it 2.5? Oh, I would say it felt more like 2.5.
I thought someone told me it was 2.5, but I could have.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, a good crowd, brilliant crowd anyway, and long may it continue. And say, as long as you get those crowds, it's on the up, isn't it, non-league football in general, and we've really enjoyed doing the little features on that.
I think more and more people are moving away from the Premier League in a lot of senses and finding it a bit, this the motivation to go into games where is lower, and actually find non-league clubs and, I've always enjoyed going to non-league games anyway, and actually then having Worthing to, to follow is actually been really fun. I've been to 5 this season. You've been to a couple more, haven't you, Russ? We've had really good days each time. I think we said the other day that the facilities at Horsham were excellent. I thought they were genuinely one of the best I've seen. You see, they're better than most lower league, not yet League 2 grounds, that sort of thing, I think, compared to a lot of them. It was brilliant, even in League 1.
Yeah, it's really good. Speaking of non-league, by the way, we'll do a quick summary of some of the divisions. I mean, it's obviously coming into the running. National League's been interesting because you've got the Hollywood Boys, obviously, of Wrexham, pushing hard in a really long, sustained run under Phil Parkinson to try and get top spot away from Stockport County, another big club for the division, former league side. But Stockport managed to lose. So did Wrexham. In fact, the Stockport had the double done over them by Yeovil. So, yeah, Stockport and Wrexham and Halifax, the top three, all lost, keeping things pretty interesting there. It does probably mean Stockport are pretty much home and dry now. It would take a gargantuan cock-up for them not to get that auto spot. But I think it's way overdue, isn't it, really, for both them and also for one of those other sides mentioned to get back up. There's so many big clubs there. Chesterfield with a new stadium, and then they got relegated out of the league. You've got Notts County, even sort of Dagenham and Redbridge, who were sort of up and down a lot, pushing there. You've got Grimsby, who've been knocking at the door for a long time. And other clubs, interesting, like Solihull Moors, who did win, who are pushing in there. It's an interesting division always. I do disagree with the bottleneck element created by the lack of promotion spots. And I do think it might end up getting rebranded as a lower EFL league division rather than non-league as it is. Interesting times, isn't it? Andy, do you follow that much at all? And what's your views on all those big clubs being down there?
It is very disconcerting when you look at like the National League thing. And it's just basically loads of league teams. And then like obviously like Bournemouth and Solihull are just like the sort of new, like the interlopers in that top half. But yeah, good to see, yeah, FC Halifax are back, you know, fighting back from like being a Phoenix club. And some interesting, yeah, it's just interesting. I mean, I'm you know, originally from Barnet, so I've been
watching. Well, they got a good win, of course, at the weekend against Hampshire's other club, Eastleigh.
Miser, yeah, so they're
that's a dig at Portsmouth, by the way.
Their rather tedious season is coming to an end, but
it's an improvement on last year, though, for Barnet.
It is, yeah, it is.
That's the one that you can say, isn't it?
Definitely. But yeah, I mean, looking through
and it, also next year they're going to be joined by a former Premier League club for the first time with Oldham.
Yes, Oldham. Yeah.
Not Southie missed out by 1 year, didn't they? Because they were in the year before the Premier League came along. But Oldham are the first former Premier League team, a club who've been so badly mismanaged and so fans have been so badly treated by the owners and somehow allowed to get away with it, as with so many teams.
Yeah, it's a real tragedy. I mean, it was inevitable, I guess. They've put up a good fight, and John Sheridan, the Shesurrection, almost worked for a while, but it was just too much to ask for, really. They're up against Salford City, who are pushing for the playoffs, who won 2-1 there to seal Oldham's fate. Stevenage have done well under Steve Evans. They've turned things around, and they won at the weekend. So it's Scunthorpe and Oldham that drop, and we now know.
Who have been, you know, I mean, Oldham have been Premier League, obviously. Scunthorpe were Championship in not a long time ago, and obviously they have their problems.
We haven't mentioned Southend, of course, being down in the National League as well. They dropped last year. But congratulations at the other end to Forest Green Rovers. First time they're going into League One. The Green Team, they've had a bit of a sticky run in, but they finally got over the line. Finishing with a goal to straw at Bristol Rovers was enough to confirm it. I showed some footage on one of the WhatsApp groups of there's a pitch invasion by the Forest Green fans. There were loads of them there, actually. I think as many as they get home would seem to be at that match. they were on the pitch, and there was one idiot from Bristol Rovers who come on the pitch trying to start a fight while wearing a St George's outfit for St George's Day. So fancy dress last home match. Looked rather ludicrous. And he couldn't get his sword to swish off any of the away fans. So, thankfully.
Exeter are very close as well, aren't they? Yeah, they need one win, I think, or a couple of points. Yeah, but
they won, so they could
third spot, including Bristol Rovers and Mansfield, both of whom were bottoms 4 or 5 at one point this season, and have had incredible runs to get up towards the playoffs. And
yeah, there's been some resurgence. You look at Forest in the Championship, and up and down the divisions, there's been a few of these incredible surges forward. And I mean, any of those could still get in there. I'm not that I can stand Joey Barton, but he is actually doing a pretty good job at Bristol Rovers, better than any of his other jobs, actually.
There's about 5 teams who could still... I mean, Exeter could still be caught by them anyway, but they're probably is Exeter second place. And then any one of 5 teams like that can still get that extra place. And it's really...
I hope Exeter go up, because they're a good club, well run, nice fans from what I've experienced, and they run the right way, and I think it's fan owned, isn't it, still, if I'm not mistaken, or at least it was until recently. Any other thoughts on League 2 before we escalate up into League 1, anybody?
No, nothing really.
I mean, League 1 has been a hell of a division. Talking about big clubs being in a division, and the promotion chase. I mean, sides like Oxford have stuck with Cole Robinson, and I like the fact they have, because I think he's, again, a good guy, and he's a good manager, plays the right way, but they just don't seem to quite have enough about them. They seem to have fallen away again this year. Other teams who are also around are Portsmouth and Ipswich.
I saw Oxford at Charlton in February when we missed out and go to the Burnley game. They won 4-0, and it could have been 7 or 8. Charlton were awful, and Oxford were brilliant.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Players to injury. I think Baldock's got injured, which is obviously one of the problems he's had. And he looked good that day. And they've just, they've lost their way. Although they had a good result of the weekend, I think, didn't they? But they're still probably just touched the playoffs.
Oxford, I think, lost to Rotherham, I think, the weekend.
Oh, they lost, did they?
Yeah. But, I mean, that some of those teams... Wickham and Rotherham, I think, are run in a very similar way. They kind of run sensibly within budgets, and they stick with managers, And if they go down, they'll stick with the guy and let him come try and bring them back up. Paul Warne at Rotherham, and obviously they've done it with Ainsworth at Wickham there. Both teams got wins, actually, against, well, you mentioned Rotherham. Oxford was 2-1 Rotherham, and Wickham beat Sheffield Wednesday. Oh, poor old Wednesday. The biggest club by far in that division, of course, they would have you believe. Anyway, I think Sunderland might have something to say about that. I can't stand Wednesday. The longer they stay down there, the funnier it is, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Same with Portsmouth for different reasons. But,
but they're another who's come from quite low down, though, at one point, to be in the top six. I mean, they were like lower middle table at one point in the season.
Yeah. And there's other big names for different reasons. Wigan, not actually a big club, but in a quite decent-sized stadium, and they've had some high-profile years.
They've won
the FA Cup, indeed, yeah. A one-all draw with Plymouth, who are a big club that really should be having more time in the Championship than they've done, which is virtually zero in the recent era. A one-all draw between those sides. Plymouth still pushing for the playoffs.
Is that the biggest place that's not had a prep the top division side or something? Is that, I make that up, or is that...
I think that might be right. If it's not right, it sounds good. So let's go with that.
Yes, Plymouth are the biggest place not to have a top flight team.
One club that's big and doesn't have a top flight team or looking anywhere like it for ages has been Sunderland, the feature of documentaries that haven't really painted things in a good light. And they just seem to be in promotion campaigns that flop every year. They're right in there again. Again, it's going to be a playoff probably if it's anything at all. 5-1 win though against Cambridge. So they're getting into the zone at the right time. All their typical scorers amongst the scorers there, Stuart Embleton and Broadhead, three of the four scorers at the weekend. But Milton Keynes Dons are probably the least popular apart from Sheffield Wednesday in the mix. 2-0 against Morecambe. They're really, and Morecambe have been in good form. Really pushing well, aren't they, MK? I mean, they're well run. I like what they do with their managers and the way they're trying to play football. They're just not a very agreeable club, obviously.
Yeah.
But in terms of as a team and as a manager, is it, I've forgotten his name now. Wilf, I don't know, something Manning, I think his name is, isn't it? Liam Manning? Something like that. But he's doing very well, and it's a left field choice of manager out of nowhere. They had Russell Martin before, didn't they? Brighton fan,
yeah.
Former professional player himself, elsewhere. But you know, they might push it really. I think with Rotherham winning as well, and I'm just trying to think who else.
The interesting thing this week midweek is that the games in hand between some of the top teams. Sunderland are playing at home to Rotherham. I was just looking.
Ooh.
That is a tasty game.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah. And it's exciting this time of year, and I love all this run-in stuff, especially when you're a neutral. You can just relax and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And also the playoffs to come soon after. I watch all of those. I mean, Andy, are you a massive playoff fan? Will you be watching all that, subject to availability? On TV, obviously.
Yeah, I'll watch some of them. I like the playoffs. Yeah. I think they're great. And actually, looking at like League One, League Two, there are a lot of meaningful games left in the league season yet, because it's all agonisingly close for teams trying to get that second promotion spot or to sneak into the playoffs. I mean, League One, Wigan and Rotherham, they've not had been in the best of form recently. And they really should have secured their spots already, but they haven't. And MK Dons are breathing down the necks of both Wigan and Rotherham, unfortunately. And then you've got Sheffield Wednesday just 1 point outside, just outside. And then look in the Championship, and that again, you've got Huddersfield, who are obviously keeping Bournemouth honest at the moment. They're only 2 points behind them. But then when you're looking at the actual playoff spots, then Millwall, Middlesbrough could still threaten Sheffield United.
Yeah. And Forest, of course, they've carried on closing the gap as well. They're kind of unsighted a bit because they're in fourth with games in hand. But they won 1-0 away at Peterborough, which probably wasn't an easy game that, because that was their death knell game for them. They needed a result, so as reflected in the tight scoreline. But Forest winning, they've still got the same number of games at Bournemouth, which is technically two in hand. They are five behind Bournemouth, but they have got them to play as well. So if they were to win that game...
Got a Fulham as well tomorrow. Mm. So they've got running Forest.
Yeah, but Fulham, of course, having secured the promotion, and they're pretty nailed on for the title there, aren't they, as well? Or have they already done that? Probably already done that.
No, they were a minute away from effectively doing it and being 12 ahead with Bournemouth having four left to them.
Oh, yeah, that was right.
So they're only nine ahead with four games left. But yeah, given the form Bournemouth are in, I don't see that overtaking. But the weird thing I just noticed is the Championship and League Two finish not this weekend, the weekend after. But the League One seems to finish this weekend because they're on 45 games, most of them. So I don't know why.
That's happened before, isn't it? I think in the last couple of seasons. I think it's something to do with trying to space it out so you get more focus feature on League One.
League One is at 12:30 on Saturday, so could be interesting.
Yeah. On that subject of Forest, though, I think Steve Cooper, who's not the best looking of gentlemen, but he's a very good manager, isn't he? I think he arguably did an even better job than Graham Potter at Swansea, and he's turned Forest from a perennial sort of failure club in terms of potential versus success. Every manager they brought in, they couldn't settle. Nobody could quite do it. Lee Johnson had a longer run. They gave him longer, but in the end, he couldn't get them over the line. And they were in a much worse position when he took over Cooper this season than they'd been in other years. And yet this is the season they look like getting closest to promotion now, because he's just completely transformed them. I don't know what his win ratio is, but it must be in the 70s or something. Yeah. It's absolutely phenomenal.
I think when he took over it, I think he was, he's done a brilliant job. And I think it was Sabri Lamouchi who had them in the playoffs for a long part of the season, and then they fell apart and didn't.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there, really.
I would love it if Forest, I'd much rather Forest came up than Bournemouth, to be honest, because it's a much nicer day out, a much more interesting trip. And we haven't been there for a while, so I'd much rather have Bournemouth to Forest than Bournemouth, personally. But probably Bournemouth will just do enough because they're at home to Forest, and Forest have to go to Fulham as well, and it's 5 points, so quite a lot to catch up anyway.
We could always pop along to Luton and knock on the mid-terrace door where the away end is and let ourselves in and go to an away game there.
Another good old Nathan Jones. Fantastic achievement. Nathan Jones did a brilliant job there going back after, he kept them up after having taken them up.
Yeah. I mean, whatever you say, one of the lowest budgets in the division, 72 points from 44 games.
And firmly in the playoffs. A playoff place now?
Luton, as a set of fans, are pretty objectionable. Can't stand them. But the club seems to be well run. And obviously, we love a bit of Nathan. So he's, if he gets them up, we've already mentioned, if they did go up as well, they'll be the only team to have gone all the way from the top division down to non-league and then back to the top division. Oldham seem to be trying to do some alternative version of that the other way around at the moment. But
he must be up on the long list of potential Albion successors to...
Well, you would think him and Cooper, actually, would both be on the list, yeah. And maybe Russell Martin longer down the line if he can continue to build his career. But I think Cooper and Jones...
Swansea finished strongly, haven't they? They might be worth watching next season if they can keep their players. Because Swansea lose quite a few because they've got quite a lot of loanees. So they obviously have quite a reasonable turnover. But if they can keep a reasonable amount, then Martin could actually do a good job there because they were low, bottom like six, like at one point, and he's taken them up to the top half pretty much. And they're still technically mathematically getting to the playoffs, although it's very unlikely. And they did a double over Cardiff for the first time ever, including a 4-0 win away from home, was it? So he's obviously got quite a lot of popularity there.
Not too bad. And at the bottom end of the table, of course, Barnsley. Well, Derby had already been relegated. Yeah. Barnsley and Peterborough took a little longer for that to happen due to games in hand, but they have now finally been relegated too. Yeah, Reading went on a good run. Bizarrely, it's Paul Ince, so I don't rate at all as a manager. But in what is effectively an interim role, he's got them into some pretty good form. They have had a couple of their better players coming back, like Joao, I think, has come in recent weeks after injury, which has probably helped them. But to be fair, I mean, that's pretty good run. Rooney, pretty unlucky with Derby, though, because, I mean, they would have been, I think, 17th, apparently, if it wasn't for the points deductions, which would have had them safe 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, and that's a situation where they've lost a lot of their best players throughout the season as well. He's not really been able to recruit anyone. I mean, they couldn't even keep Bulldog in January because they weren't allowed extend contracts and he had to go into
all the uncertainty in general hanging over them and players nearly everyone's out of contract barring about four players, so there's that sort of element builds in as well when you are playing, if you are still around for the rest of the season, that could affect things, can't it? So I mean, unlucky for him. To be fair, he's done a good job, hasn't he, Rooney?
I think he has.
Interesting to see what he does next, whether it's Derby again or somebody else, who knows. Any thoughts on that or anything else, Andy, before we go into the Premier League roundup?
No, not really. I think, you know, you've already commented on Luton, and I think given the way that modern football is just so stacked in favour of big budget teams, particularly the Championship, you have to spend an awful lot of money to get out of the division, and they've done it with the second lowest budget in the division. It's an absolutely incredible story. And like you say, I don't really like Luton fans that much, but how can you not be totally impressed by what they've done there this season? It's absolutely brilliant from Nathan Jones. Clearly, the people who are running Luton now have got that team looking forward to the future in a positive manner. It really seems to be on the up, and it would be fantastic if they actually managed to get through in the playoffs.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, on to the Prem then. We've obviously discussed the Albion, but elsewhere, lots going on. Let's start at the top, actually, because City and Liverpool, thankfully, Liverpool got the draw at Man City, which has kept things alive. And it's looking like a hell of a run-in. 5 games each left to play. City are 1 ahead. It doesn't look like the goal difference will matter unless City slipped up with 2 draws and Liverpool lost a game. I don't think there's any other way goal difference is going to come into it. But Liverpool's goal difference is better, for what it's worth. But they're a point behind. No one else anywhere near them. Any thoughts on that? I mean, I would imagine my inclination is that both teams are going to win all of their games. I can't see many slip-ups there, if any. But hopefully, if that is the case, it'll go to the wire, at least, if that happens, which will be interesting. We couldn't be the party poopers in the week, of course, but maybe someone else can. Wolves apparently do quite well against City. And, you know, there's a couple of other things that could shake things up. But
I think there will be a spanner chucked in the works, because I just think City are just a little bit short. I think Liverpool is so much more confident than City now. I think City really want to win the Champions League, and obviously they've got Real Madrid, so they've got the tougher of the two, well, on paper, the tougher of the two semi-finals, you would think. And so they might be more distracted by that than... Whereas Liverpool, actually, I think, really want to win the league. And they probably want to win the Champions League as well. But I think they would rather win the league than the Champions League. And I think City would rather win the Champions League than the league, to be honest. So I think there are different competing pressures mentally there. And I think if I was going to say which one is the more fragile, I would say City are the slightly more fragile of the two teams. So I would not be surprised to see them... maybe, you know, draw a game if they've got to play Wolves. I mean, Wolves are just literally, you're just playing a brick wall, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's those sort of teams that they're dropping points to. I think someone said they dropped points in both games against Palace, was it, or someone like that, and Southampton as well. So, you know, it's those sort of teams that they slip up to. It's not Chelsea away. You kind of almost think, oh, they'll probably win at Chelsea, but Wolves, maybe not. And yeah, that makes it interesting, doesn't it? And I think Liverpool, I think they're at home to Spurs, aren't they?
And
they've just had back-to-back games against the grudge match sides, you know, and they've swept United aside, and then Everton gave them a good go, but they, you know, they've won both of those games where City would have looked and thought, but certainly the fans at least would have been thinking these are the games they might slip up in. Maybe not so much Man U because they are that bad, but Everton, you always thought that was going to be a bit of a grudge match, and it was quite physical a bit, I think, as well. But I do think in the end, yeah, I agree with you, Andy. I think Liverpool would lean towards the title. City would lean towards the Champions League, much as they both want to win both.
Especially if Liverpool win the FA Cup as well. The idea of winning the domestic treble would be pretty big for them.
Yeah. And of course, they could win the quadruple as well. City already can't now win the traditional treble because they're out of the FA Cup, of course. But it's all brilliant. I mean, the stand of these teams is incredible, isn't it? I mean, Liverpool, we mentioned the Man U game. A 9-0 aggregate against Man United. And I know that's a poor incarnation of the Red Devils. It's such a shame. I'm crying my eyes out. But apparently the 9-0 is, I think it's the biggest margin of victory over the two games since 1896, I think it was, they were saying on Match of the Day. And it's also the first time one player scored 5 goals in league matches against the same team, against Man United, in history, which was Salah, who's got a hat-trick in the away match and 2 goals in midweek.
They were just creating that game. I I did tune in and watch. I watched most of it.
Thiago, they were just
sensational. I think they were already winning by the time I actually put the game on.
They scored in.
It could have been 10.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been fun if it had been 10 as well.
They just utterly destroyed United, who just had no confidence or backbone.
And quite honestly, we moaned briefly on the Tottenham Matchday special about City fans singing songs through the minute silence for Hillsborough. Well, Man United fans disgracefully were singing songs about Hillsborough at Anfield. I don't know at what point in the game that happens, because Lineker mentioned it on Match of the Day highlights on that midweek show. But this comes on the same game where Ronaldo just lost his baby boy, which obviously is tragic news, awful story there. Ronaldo sat the game out, but there was a minute's applause, I think, in the sixth minute. Presumably that was the age, or seventh minute. Is that the age of his son, I'm guessing?
For his shirt number.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's the seventh minute, yeah. And all of the Liverpool fans were applauding all around the ground, which is a touch of class. And quite often they've done stuff like that, which I think is great. I like to think, at least, that Hillsborough singing was before that happened. If it happened after that, it's even more disgusting, given how generous Liverpool fans have been. You know, you'd expect them to be like that, but at least they were. But United, there's a history of them doing it in the past. And quite frankly, you know, it's probably a minority, but they are fans. You can't just say they're not real United fans, because they've got away tickets to Liverpool. So they are real fans. And they've got that attitude. It absolutely sickens me when anybody does stuff like that.
There has been songs sung about Munich as well at games by...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree. So Liverpool fans have done that. No, not at all. You're right. The only thing the only difference for me is Hillsborough is more recent and it involves a lot of supporters. So those victims, you know for sure, particularly at Anfield, that there are going to be close relatives of deceased listening to that.
I agree, but I'm not saying that makes it any better. Yeah, you can't defend either of them, I don't think. They're both equally abhorrent. And
the actual things. Yeah. The sentiment of things is abhorrent, yeah.
There's being a kind of a football fan and shouting abuse at away fans or home fans, and then there's singing about tragedies like that. And it's, either whether or not it was players or fans or whatever, it was.
Yeah, it's classless in the extreme, yeah.
Changing topic slightly, but still on Liverpool there. Amongst the nice stats at the weekend of their 83% possession, that's the most ever in a Premier League match, I think, was the stat about Alan, which I thought was hilarious, was he only had completed two successful passes, 70-odd minutes on the pitch, and both were from kickoff, he's a really good player as well. So I don't know what happened to him. He just bypassed
I don't know. There was a diagram showing his other passes. There were six other passes, which all just seemed to go off the pitch or something. It's just awful. Ironically, I mean, they worked well in midfield. They worked really hard to close Liverpool down. And I think Alan was amongst those mentioned as doing a lot of hard work. So it's not as if he had a complete mare out and out. But in terms of passing, what was going on there?
That's crazy. Give it away from the kickoff, though, I suppose.
Yeah, that could have been impressive, couldn't it? Of course, midweek we lost to City, so the title race was still on. And at the weekend, as I said, Liverpool thrashed, beat Everton, and Man City thrashed Watford, didn't they? 5-1, with Jesus scoring four goals. Blimey. Well, he certainly takes his chances when he gets back into the team, doesn't he? In terms of the rest of
the resurrection recently, over.
Yeah. Chelsea, despite some slip-ups, they're going to finish third, I think, aren't they? Arsenal seem to be gaining the edge, don't they? I mean, a brilliant win at Chelsea, 4-2 in midweek, and then they got the 3-1 win over Man United at the weekend. 2 points clear at the moment of Spurs, and United are another four back, so they're dead in the water, and they played an extra game.
And an extra game played as well, United, isn't it? I think. Yeah. I mean, it's a game more than them.
Yeah, I mean, West Ham are only two behind them, so they might not even get the Europa place.
They've also got a game in hand, so
and they're for three behind them. So they, if United miss out on Europe altogether, I'm happy with that.
In fairness, that might actually benefit the new manager. Actually, might be quite happy if they miss out on the Europa League or Europa Conference League, and they get a proper chance to focus on the on the domestic football for the first season. That might actually suit him if they're not going to get to the Champions League. It might.
The Albion, obviously, with what's happened at the weekend, Brentford got a draw to get above us briefly. We subsequently, our draw took us back above Brentford by a point. But Leicester are ahead of us. Newcastle are up to ninth now with a 3-0 away win at Norwich. Boo hiss. I mean, they are now two clear of us from the same number of games played. It's irritating that we weren't able to stay above them. And I've got a feeling we won't get back above them, but who knows? We are, hopefully we could stay above Brentford just purely for positional reasons, Southampton for mixed reasons, and Palace, who are three behind us, but they've now got two games in hand, one of which is tonight as we record. Four behind. Yeah, I was looking at Brentford's total. Four behind. And they've got the better goal difference, annoyingly, so a win and a draw would do it.
Yeah, but quite a lot ahead of us on goal difference, aren't they now?
I'm desperate for us to finish above them. Just please, you know, year after year, they seem to do it, regardless of ineptitude or anything else. They seem to always get there. I really want us to finish above them.
To be fair, this season, they've actually deserved it, if they have, because they've actually played some quite good football under Vieira.
We probably deserved it when we got there.
Whoever finishes higher will deserve it this season, though, because they've played some good stuff and we have. Whereas previous seasons, they basically picked it under Hodgson and kind of like come to us and had 2% possession and nicked it with their one shot on target all game or whatever. Yeah. Or penalty from like Batshuayi. Whereas this season, to be fair, they played some good football, although they had a lucky, easy draw, they got to the cup semi-final. They've done pretty well generally. And considering, as much as I hate to say, considering Fiera's first season and he didn't come with the greatest record, frankly, previously elsewhere. They've done pretty well, generally. It's annoying because I was really hoping they go down this season, but they've not even looked in danger. Relegation, though.
Last but by no means least.
There is a big team who are, after they lost to Liverpool, that we can very much in danger.
I mean, this has taken a turn, hasn't it? I've been having a round with a friend of the show, Andy Bravery, about points totals that would have been the amount to survive, and I'm insisting that 33 would have been the amount. What I didn't account for... probably not now, because what's happened is Burnley have gone on a two-game winning streak, coupled with the aforementioned form of Everton. Everton have now dropped to 2 points behind Burnley, which, of course, was before they kicked off against Liverpool, but inevitably they lost that game. They're still two behind. They've got one more game in hand, which is against Watford. But then Burnley have got Watford to play anyway in the run-in, so that doesn't really give them much advantage there. They're in real trouble here. Burnley, I know they've changed managers, but Burnley in general have that essence and that fighting spirit type of thing about them, haven't they? And it looks like they've got it back now, just in time,
especially at home,
to give them a chance. And Everton are not equipped for a relegation battle. They've spent, somebody mentioned that Liverpool spent, I think it was 782 million on the current setup of their squad, if you count everybody through whenever they were bought. And Everton has spent something like 827 million, even more than Liverpool. I know they already had a good base to work with, Liverpool, but to spend that amount of money, whoever you're comparing it with, and to be in a relegation battle when you are probably now favourites for the drop from those two teams, absolutely ridiculous.
Yes, you compare that to Burnley's squad, you wonder what they cost in comparison.
Yeah, exactly. They've probably got the smallest budget, haven't they, more or less? Or they did before Cornet, anyway, and Veghorst. But Norwich, and no one's down yet, but Norwich obviously losing 3-0 at home to Newcastle. We already know they're dead in the water. They're 10 adrift with 5 to play. Watford are 9 adrift with 5 to play. Everton have the game in hand over everyone. Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's a 2-point gap. Burnley are 5 better off on goal difference, which could
and a nicer
play.
Running as well.
Yeah.
And we can't also rule out the third team, a favourite team of the shows, Leeds United.
Leeds, they've got a tough run in.
Fully out of it.
They've arguably got the toughest run in.
Yeah, if they don't get to hit Palace tonight, they could yet be fooled in. Win at Palace, I think it would be okay.
But before four ahead of Everton, but they would have played the extra their game in hand. So Everton would then have the Watford game in hand on Watford on Leeds. And Leeds' goal difference is terrible. It's already 9 worse than Everton now. So it's not out of the question. I mean, from one point of view, and I know Robin's mentioned this point a few times as well in conversations, The ideal one from an Albion point of view, just to think about teams that could be above us next year, it's probably ideal if Everton went down, not only for the novelty value, but they could go again, couldn't they, next year with the Premier League money still coming in. Burnley and Leeds.
I don't see Burnley spending big anyway, if they stay up their own. I don't see that interested in throwing money at the club.
And Leeds will probably... Leeds will probably lose Rafinha. They might have just lost their mojo. No guarantee they're going to spend a load of money. I could see Leeds and Burnley struggling next year, potentially. I guess Everton.
A lot will depend on Phillips signing a new deal and whether Bamford comes back and falls like in the first season.
They missed Phillips, didn't they?
I thought he was that great, but somehow in the first season, he was annoyingly good and scored a load of goals. And he'd never done that before as a one-off. And then this season, to be fair, he's been injured quite a lot. So next season will be almost like his second season and how he does after that.
Who's your hunch? Who are you going to say is going down then?
I think Everton might go now. I think one at home and draw one at home, but Burnley will nick a win at home as well. And yeah, I think Everton are in real trouble now. Lampard's not a man who's used to this sort of battle. No. The players aren't used to it, and I don't think they're necessarily going to be. And it would
it's
be, really...
be more pressure, isn't there, from the home crowd if things aren't going well in games?
You just wonder about the mentality of some of the Everton players. I think the problem that Everton have had in recent, it's just seemed to be very much a mercenary type club.
Yeah.
They'll have like one or two like younger homegrown players who will always seem to outshine the person they've just spent 40 million quid on. I mean, people saying, oh, why don't the Albion spend 50 million pounds on a striker? Well, look at the rubbish that Everton have continually spent in excess of like 30, 40 million pounds on.
They signed three players for the same position at one point, didn't they? And spent a fortune on.
Oh, yeah, they had like about four.
Sigurdsson and.
Four number nines, didn't they? But I mean, it's just a really badly run club. I think Lampard has shown that it really kind of isn't the manager's fault because each manager has come up against the same problems. So, you know, it's just a very disjointed football club at the moment. It doesn't appear to be massively stable. We don't know if they're going to get this new stadium or not. It's all sorts of stuff going on. They overspend.
I mean, the finances are crazy.
I think they have had some FFP trouble, haven't they? I think.
Yeah, and that's going to get worse if they go down. I mean, the published figures were fairly recently.
I think there's a lot of players that are probably already on the phone to their agents and saying, well, you know, can you get me out the back door here? You know, I have no interest in being here next season. I think...
Yeah, and a lot of them their wages are probably very high.
They do have the game in hand. And if they win it, then I actually think they might pull through and just pip Burnley.
Part of me thinks the same, that they can't help thinking... Typical relegation battle. There's another twist, at least one more.
But it'll be by a point. I mean, Burnley actually have the edge and goal difference. They're five goals better off.
I'm going to call Everton, but I do think you could end up being right.
Frankly, any of those three go down, I'm quite happy anyway. But I think there's two examples I gave from January this year of what I think is wrong with Everton. One was selling Luca Dean and getting rid of Marcel Brands. For football, because Benitez didn't break them, and then sacking Benitez a week later, which made absolutely no sense. And then when they clearly were struggling, and they didn't believe they were, obviously, but they obviously were down the bottom, I think there's an example that you were trying to say, Russ, it's like bringing in Dele Alli, Donny van der Beek in the same day when they didn't need attacking midfielders. They had Sigurdsson, they've got all sorts of attacking players, Richarlison, Calvert-Lewin. What they needed was someone solid at the back and someone in midfield, maybe. They did not need more attackers. And, Dele Alli's done absolutely nothing there. I don't know what's happened to him.
Who knew that was going to not happen?
Yeah. But I don't know what's happened to him over the last few years, because in the last World Cup, he was one of England's key players and he was a key part of Tottenham's run to the European final. And then something's happened the last couple of years that it's just not worked out for him.
The other thing to mention, I don't know when Everton's game in hand with Watford is, but just to mention before, also, this weekend on Saturday, Burnley are away at Watford, and for what it's worth, Leeds have got Man City. And then on Sunday, Everton are playing at home to Chelsea. So, you know, by the time Everton kick off in that game, they could be 5 points adrift here. Assuming yeah. I couldn't see a game in hand this week.
No, I think you're right. They're playing Watford in the middle of May.
Watford have the worst defence, I think, I've ever seen in a Premier League. And that previously I would have said it was one of any one of the Fulham relegations.
I think Burnley win this game, don't they?
But Watford, they...
They're dreadful.
They're just amazingly capable bad. Of not conceding a goal. I mean, if
even horrendous in both games we played,
they would find a way of making sure that their opponent scored.
Yeah, it's that bad. I don't see them bouncing back up, do you? And to be honest with you, I've got nothing against Watford, the people or the fans or anything, but I don't want teams like Watford to succeed when they've got the managerial policy they've got, and I don't like the way they're run, and quite honestly, I want that to fail, really. I think Norwich just simply weren't too modest means. Watford, partly that, but just the way they're run. I'm quite glad if they go down, to be honest. No offence to Watford fans, but I don't want that model to succeed, really. Ironically, you know, Burnley might survive getting rid of a manager when they could have stuck with one, but
they've stuck with their manager for a long time, to be fair.
They had done, to be honest, different regime.
I thought it was a stupid decision, but frankly, it's worked so far. They've got a couple of good results out of it. Yeah. I wonder whether they'll stick with the interim manager while it's working, rather than a permanent one.
Well, one thing for next season is Fulham have already got promoted, so they're already up. They are going to swap with Watford, you could argue. And that would make seven proper London games, not six London games and Watford and call that seven. Why do people keep doing that? Watford is not in bloody London. I know it's close, but it's not in London. But next season we could have, we're going to have seven London clubs to visit. And
if we had 19, we'd probably win the Premier League, given our
record. Exactly. Speaking of which, on the previous Albion-related episode, the Spurs matchday special, I think it was, I quoted unbeaten away form as an away fan. I am incorrect. Peter, you had a feeling I'd been to Villa, and I said I hadn't. Alan, friend of the show, has pointed out I definitely did go to Villa, because that's where I twisted my ankle. Yeah. So apologies to everyone for myself getting that one wrong. And also, I got something else wrong. We did say on the Worthing, the mini match day special, I said George Dowell is chairman and owner. Of course, he isn't the chairman. Barry Hunter is, but he is the owner. So just to correct...
Don't bring me down with your incorrect statement.
Well, I did point it out after trying to claim it. But anyway, yes, these little faux pas will occur, of course. Final word...
I'm not, you know, the one about a Worthing chairman is kind of acceptable. The fact that you don't remember going to a place...
Well, I blanked it out of my mind, of course, because I hate losing a Villa. Wish I'd not gone.
So did I.
As it stands, we've done the double over Brentford and Watford, and we've now had two doubles done over us, the aforementioned Villa and, of course, Man City. We've still got one or two to avoid, haven't we? Man United being one of those, Wolves being another. And who else have we got? Well, Leeds
and West Ham.
So I'd like it to stay even, wouldn't you? Just two of each, two doubles done, two doubles inflicted. I think that would suit me. I think we can beat Man United. I hope we can. We're so overdue some luck against them, or decisions, to be more exact. But before that, we have Wolves. So quick word on Wolves. It's the next match is on Saturday, away from home. Kickoff is at 3, I think. That one, is it?
Yeah.
Are either of you guys going to that game?
No.
Same here. Can't be bothered. Not the most attractive fixture. Head-to-head record. We're actually in the ascendancy there. Well, not the ascendancy. We're in the lead. We've had 15 wins, 14 draws, and only 8 losses. So not too bad.
It was a long time you went without losing against them.
Yeah, we were a bogey team for them, weren't we? Yeah. How do you see that one going, guys? I fancy a draw. 0-0, and he's holding up. Is that the Trossard celebration?
It's 0-0. It's one game that has got 0-0 written all over it. Surely it's this one.
Yeah, yeah.
The team that don't let any goals in against the team that refuses to score.
I'm on 0-0 with that as well, definitely. Not that I ever get any of these scores.
That would be good point. That would get us to 42. That would be our record. It gives us
Yeah, for Premier League era.
Something to look forward to in the remaining games, because, you know, our games against, you know, Leeds, Man United and West Ham they're always quite entertaining matches. It's, you know, those are games that you would not be betting 0-0 on. All three of those, you'd be thinking, no, we've got, you know, something's going to happen in these games. So that
was 4-3 at Wolves and a 0-0 after that. Then,
yeah, well, that is quite an entertaining run in. You know, just especially as we're not in any imminent peril, which we normally are going into those fixtures. So obviously we don't want to lose them all. I think we are seriously fighting for every point that we can get. And as disappointing as a Southampton game was, I don't think you could accuse us of not trying to win it. We certainly were. We just, you know, the execution wasn't what we wanted it to be. But, you know, we are not on the beach at the moment. I think it'll be a tough game. Wolves have just done very well at what they do. I mean, they're just really hard to beat, you know.
He's got things going there, hasn't he, the new guy? And he's really turned it round. And also the other thing is, I mean, it's so packed in the area we're in. If you look from, or below Wolves actually, from Newcastle in ninth through to, well, I guess Villa in 15th, it's all very close. There's only 6 points between still. Villa and Palace at the bottom of that list have got games in hand. So points are going to be vital for the thing we've mentioned before, you know, the cash prize levels for different positions in the table. We don't want to be on the beach. We can't afford to be on the beach, really. If we get 6.6 million more for finishing three places above by having the extra impetus, I really want us to take that.
Striker for us, because that's our striker budget.
Yeah.
On the other hand, though, I also do want to see something of Sarmiento, for example. And I do think, yes, you've got to balance the fact you want results, but also, you know, I almost see a Bissouma if he's on the way for the last couple of games and see how we manage with that. So while the benefit, you know, we've shown we can manage without the weekend, maybe at least one game where he doesn't start, give Sarmiento a start, give one or two others a start, maybe who are a bit on the fringes. You know,
we wouldn't necessarily harm the result anyway. Really?
Yeah, exactly. And see how things go, and, you know, maybe not start Trossard every game because there's a chance he might not be there next season. And yeah, just give a few players a go, and rather than just playing the same team and kind of, and also sentimentally seeing, because I think he might certainly go in the summer, I wouldn't mind seeing Duffy start one game just to sort of say goodbye and kind of, I think he's a brilliant servant to the club, but I find it hard to believe he'll be here next season.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's it. Just final notices, I think, a couple of bits to mention. Seagulls over London, we've got Paul Barber coming up on Wednesday, so that's going to be interesting. We'll probably ask him about bottle tops and mustard jumpers and all the rest. Should be an entertaining event. One that's just gone on, there was a Legends dinner, wasn't there, on, I think it was on Friday, where a load of ex-players and managers, Steve Gritt and various others gathered together for a Legends night to celebrate 25th anniversary related to, of course, the war years and that fateful season where we just survived. There's also, of course, the Renf stuff coming up. I think details are online, but it's a two-legged thing, isn't it, Renf this year? I think Croydon FC followed by down in Lancing for the return game.
Yeah, Croydon on Friday. So
annoyingly, I don't think I can go to that. I really wanted to go, actually. It would have been another new ground.
I am planning on going at the moment.
Excellent.
I'm hoping I can make that
Croydon link. Who's playing? Is Brett playing, Andy? Do you know in the game?
He's managing.
He's a manager nowadays, isn't he? Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So we've got Alan Wares and AD at the back. Have we from Albion Raw playing as a central defensive partnership, maybe? No, it should be a good fun affair. And look up the details online. I'm sure you'll be able to find it. Also, of course, there's a Renf quiz coming up soon. I think Alan's doing something related to the 25 years since then as the theme.
Yes, I'm going to that as well.
Yeah, should be good. Look it up and get along, or contribute and donate if you can, folks. Meantime, that wraps it up for us. Just to say, we've signed up with Patreon recently, and we've got our first Patreon on there as well. So thank you to whoever that is. We're going to look it up later. I haven't actually looked into it yet, but thank you to him. And if anyone else wants to join, you can do so by signing up, going to www.patreon.com /BrightonRockPod. Also, if you can rate and review us, the usual stuff, you know, Apple, Spotify, any other means by which you can rate, review our podcast, all of that would help us. Please do if you can. 5-star reviews, thumbs up, all that stuff would be great. In the meantime, that wraps up this bumper review and general reflections on the run-in episode with me and with Peter and with Andy. So thank you, Andy, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Good to see you at the weekend as well for a couple of drinks. And at least we did get some sun and a half decent result, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Couple of goals.
And yeah, goals. Open goals. Play goals again at home this time. Who knew? We're going to be able to do that.
Our first goals from at all in 5 home games. Well, to be fair, they score one of them.
And I know some people have just not seen any of them. They missed the Brentford game and they're away on holiday in August. So, you know, they've literally missed virtually all of it or all of it. And I did fear for anyone in that boat who may have arrived at the ground late on Sunday might have thought they'd missed the one and only open goal they were likely to see on the afternoon. But thankfully we got two. Anyway, thank you very much, Andy, for joining us. And we will no doubt see you again soon. And Peter, stand or fall?
Up the Albion.
Sports Social Podcast Network.